From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Elvis Costello. His entire catalog of recordings is currently being reissued on Rhino Records. We'll feature highlights from Costello's Fresh Air interviews and performances. And film critic John Powers reviews The Mothman Prophecies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department has identified the fifth suspected al-Qaeda member. His so-called martyrdom video was found along with four others in Afghanistan. The man, al-Rauf bin al-Habib bin Youssef al-Jidi, is Canadian. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
Attorney General John Ashcroft said the video was found in the home of Mohammed Atef, the military commander of al-Qaeda, who was killed in the American bombing. Last week, Ashcroft released pictures of five men, but could only identify four. But he said further forensic analysis solved the puzzle.
We identified al-Jidi through discovery of a suicide letter found in the ruins of the Atef residence by the U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan.
The Canadian government says al-Jidi has fled the country. The FBI has retouched the pictures of all five men who appeared in the videotapes to show what each person would look like with a westernized appearance. Ashcroft said the FBI is looking for another man, a supposed associate of al-Jidi's, named Fakhar Bousara. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
Police in suburban Houston, Texas, say a former Enron executive has apparently taken his own life. Police say former Enron Vice Chairman Clifford Baxter was found dead in a car with a suicide note and a bullet wound to the head. Baxter was 43. Baxter resigned from the collapsed energy company in May of last year. He was mentioned in a memo written by Enron executive Sharon Watkins, warning that Enron's accounting practices might get the company into trouble. Watkins' memo cited Baxter as someone who complained about the inappropriateness of some of Enron's accounting transactions. Israeli warplanes launched missile strikes against Palestinian targets in the Gaza Strip and West Bank, injuring at least seven people. The strikes came hours after a suicide bomb attack in Tel Aviv that wounded some two dozen. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Israel Radio and Palestinian witnesses reported that Israeli F-16 fighter jets launched missile attacks on Palestinian security buildings in Gaza City and the West Bank city of Tulkarm. No Palestinian group claimed responsibility for the suicide bomb attack earlier in the day in Tel Aviv. Police said a bomber blew himself up in a crowded neighborhood near the old bus terminal, wounding two dozen people, three of them seriously. Israel blamed Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat for the bombing. Arafat's Palestinian Authority issued a statement condemning any attack against Israeli civilians. In Washington, Secretary of State Colin Powell said U.S. policy toward the Palestinians is under review. Potential sanctions are said to include the suspension of envoy Anthony Zinni's peace mission in the region. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 44 points to close at 9,840 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq lost 4 points to close at 1,937. This is NPR News. A federal judge in Illinois has sentenced an anti-abortion militant to 30 years in prison. Clayton Lee Wagner was captured last month in Ohio after having escaped from jail in Illinois almost a year ago. While he was free, Wagner claimed responsibility for sending more than 500 letters to reproductive health centers and abortion rights groups, claiming that the letters contained anthrax spores. The letters were all hoaxes. British Airways and American Airlines have rejected the U.S. government's conditions on their proposed alliance. The airlines say the price is too high. NPR's Marianne Akers reports.
The Transportation Department said earlier today it would approve the American-British Airways deal as long as the airlines allowed other U.S. carriers access to London's coveted Heathrow Airport. In a joint statement, the two airlines said the U.S. government's conditions don't make sense for either company. They wrote, "We will not acquiesce to unrealistic and, in our view, unnecessary demands." The Transportation Department had asked them to give up more than 200 flights between the U.S. and London. It would have allowed four other U.S. airlines the right to land at Heathrow. Otherwise, the government said the deal would drive up ticket prices and reduce choices for passengers. Currently, only four airlines can fly between U.S. airports and Heathrow. They are United, American, British Airways, and Virgin Atlantic. Marianne Akers, NPR News, Chicago.
The Pentagon says it intends to stand by a new policy that says American servicewomen may appear in public in Saudi Arabia without being covered from head to toe in a traditional robe. Saudi officials have said they won't permit the new policy to take effect. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new weekly program that explores issues, events, and ideas shaping the world. Fridays at 9 on PBS. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Songwriter, singer, and guitarist Elvis Costello was at the forefront of the new wave music of the 70s. Over the years, his music has evolved. He's composed and recorded country songs, collaborated with chamber music groups, and co-wrote an entire CD's worth of songs with Burt Bacharach. The complete Elvis Costello catalog is gradually being released on Rhino Records. Each album contains two CDs, one with the original material, the other featuring alternate takes, demos, and other material from the vaults. Costello has been a guest several times on Fresh Air. We're going to listen back to highlights of those interviews, starting with his first in 1989. But let's begin with a track from his first album, released in America in 1977.
Now that your picture's in the paper being perfectly admired, you can have it a one that you have ever desired. All you gotta tell me now is wow, 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 wow. Welcome to the working week. Oh, I know it don't thrill you. I hope it don't kill you. Welcome to the working week. You gotta do it till you do it, so you better get to it. All of your family has to kill to survive. And this is waiting for their big day to arrive. But if they do what I feel, they better be alive. Welcome to the working week. Oh, I know.
Welcome to The Working Week from Elvis Costello's first album, My Aim Is True. It's not just the great music that captured attention, it was his album photo. Although he had appropriated the King of Rock's first name, he was wearing Buddy Holly-style glasses and was posed as if he were doing a knock-kneed duck walk. In 1989, I asked him about that photo.
I remember doing that photo session. I had two jackets at this point. That's all I had, two jackets. You know, I was trying them on, and we did some shots with this tweed jacket, and that even considering I was wearing horn rims, that seemed a little bit too serious. So I put on this other jacket, it was kind of a mohair jacket, and I said, we're happening now, and I had my electric guitar, which we didn't have plugged in, so that immediately makes it kind of comical. And I think all I remember is the photographer Keith Morris and my manager, both of them guzzling bottles of cider, which was our chosen drink because it was very cheap. Sort of all going, go on, throw the funny legs, you know, do some of those rock and roll. But kind of as a send-up of that, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So contrary to the image of the intense, sort of furious young man that's often written about in such romantic terms by rock critics, we were having a joke at the expense of all that imagery. And people fail to see the gag, you know, obviously, because it you're frozen there for a moment, and it came to represent something else, because the music obviously wasn't humorous like that. It was aggressive, you know. So there's a curious little inside story, you know.
You've brought a guitar with you. Would it be okay for me to ask you to sing a song?
Sure. I'll get out this guitar here. I'll sing the song I wrote in Greenland. Can I sing a song I wrote?
Sure. Yeah.
This is a first on public radio. Here we go. song written in Greenland, 500 miles above the Arctic Circle, in a place called Uummannaq.
I wish you'd known me when I was alive. I was a funny fella. The crowd would hoot and holler for more. I wore a drunk's red nose for applause. Oh yes, I was a comical priest with a joke for the flock and a hand up your fleece. Drool and the drink and the lipstick and grease paint down the cardboard front of my dirty dog collar. Now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, now I'm dead, and I'm going on to meet my reward. I was scared, I was scared, I was scared, I was scared. He might have never heard God's comic. So there he was on a waterbed.
Elvis Costello recorded in 1989 after the release of his album Spike. When he came back to Fresh Air in 1994 after the release of his CD Brutal Youth, we talked about his father. I know your father sang in with bands. He was a band singer.
Yeah, with one band, really, most of the time.
And which band was that?
It was the Joe Loss Orchestra.
So he sang, like, pop standards?
Well, I suppose when he started in the 50s, it would have been much more the typical big band ballad. But a lot of those bands kind of folded up in that time, obviously, as the guitar-based music took over more.
Yeah.
You know, that was... that was death for really those big bands, which were obviously modelled on sort of like the Glenn Miller sound or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Joe Loss and his arrangers were very, very shrewd, and they managed to kind of absorb a lot of the music. And my father is a very versatile singer, and they did the most unlikely covers. You know, they used to cover very contemporary pop records, and, you know, they would do things like See Emily Play by Pink Floyd, you know, with these outlandish arrangements. I mean, I said Dave Gilmore about that I had this. I know he didn't play on that record, but I told him this. I said, I bet you any money the original Pink Floyd couldn't play See Emily Play live, because it's a very complex arrangement. It was a studio creation. And here I've got this tape of a radio broadcast from 1968 with my father singing it with this extraordinary band arrangement. It's very bizarre, you know, quite surreal.
Now, did you share a musical taste with him, or did you rebel against his songs?
They both really love jazz and singers such as Ella Fitzgerald and Sinatra and people like that. So I didn't really have any feeling of rebellion against that, because that was the music that was in the house when I was really little. And then it obviously, like most people, you get to a certain age where you assert your own choice about music, and that happened to be right at a great period of English pop music, you know, with the Beatles and
mm-hmm.
all of that sort of stuff, which they also liked. I can't ever remember them not liking something that was good. I dare say my father had to sing sometimes a song that he didn't care for. And my mother, you know, on the other hand, liked a lot of classical music and took me to concerts when I was little. So I got a little taste for that. So I nothing really seemed like off limits, or as if it didn't really belong to me, or I was prejudiced against it.
When you started to sing, did your father think you had what it takes? Or did he not take your voice seriously?
No, he was very encouraging. You know, both my parents were. I never let them come and see me, but...
You wouldn't let them come and see
not
you?
Not when I first started out, no.
Well, because you were... Why?
Well, I suppose you just wanted to learn how to do it first, and uh-huh. it was kind of embarrassing. But later on, you know, they come to see me play now, and, I can talk about the records with them that I make now.
Would it have been embarrassing early on to have your parents show up at a gig?
Oh, God, I think it would be for anybody, you know, when you're sort of 16 or 17, you know. And my son plays in a band now, and I went to see him play recently, but I had to creep in the back door in disguise.
That's funny, you having to sneak in through mm-hmm. the back door. So how famous was your father when he was singing with the band?
Among a certain kind of clientele for that, for dance music, you know, they were pretty well known. I mean, they were one of the better known. Certainly the orchestra was very well known in the country.
Did changing your name have anything to do with wanting to be independent from your father's reputation?
Oh, no, not really. It wasn't like a Frank Sinatra Jr. situation.
Right,
you know,
right,
I mean,
right,
it was.
Right.
I mean, he had had some success. They didn't do that many recordings, so that meant that the fame really revolved around the live performance in dance halls. There were a few recordings, and he did have one hit record in Germany under his own name, as opposed to a performance with the orchestra, you know. No, not really. There wasn't any problem about that.
Did he take it personally when you changed his name? Did he want you to...
No, funnily enough, he had already used the same surname as an alias when doing a cover record, you know, that he had done as a session singer, because he used to do some recording things under other names.
So he used Costello?
Yeah, because it's his grandmother's name.
So is that why you used it?
Yeah. Huh. No, I just plucked it out of the air.
Well, who knows? Who knows? And you used Elvis because of Presley, no doubt.
Well, that was my manager's idea. I think at the time, there were people with very, very obviously fake names, you know, all the punk names.
Right.
And one certainly more enduring, I would say, better way to really, really make people sit up and take notice was to take the name, take a name that, like, in most people's minds, there could only ever be one of. I mean, really, it was a statement of saying, well, here's a singular person, you know. And we didn't exactly debate the significance of it beyond that.
Elvis Costello recorded in 1994. We'll hear an excerpt of his 1996 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Oh, I know that she has made a fool of him, like girls have done so many nights before. Time and time again. But he's so strange, I don't know why. But somebody has to cry. No dancer when they get old.
All of Elvis Costello's recordings are being released by Rhino Records. We're listening back to excerpts of Costello's Fresh Air interviews. In 1996, after the release of his CD, All This Useless Beauty, Costello brought his guitar to our studio, but we started by playing a track from the CD.
Why can't a man stand alone? Must he be burdened by all that is taught to consider his own? His skin and his station, his kin and his crown, his flag and his nation, they just weigh him down. You know, pride is a sin that we tend to forgive, but it gets hard to live when you don't have the love in your heart to begin with. Why can't a man stand alone?
This is a wonderful song. Tell me about how you wrote it, when you wrote it.
Well, I had it in mind to write like a big, like gospel-based or R&B-based ballad of this kind with very clear lyrics. And in fact, I didn't know that I was really the voice for it when I came up with it. I had it in mind that Sam Moore might record it, from the singer from Sam and Dave. So I had it in mind to give it to somebody else to really sing it in a very forthright way. And I think it gave me the confidence to speak very clearly in the lyrics of the song in a way that I hadn't always done when I had to sing them myself. So a few years later, having sort of thought about the song and kind of plucked up the courage to sing it vocally, I think I found the right voice on the record for it that wasn't too strident, that softened at the right moments in the story.
Why did writing for somebody else bring out new things in your songwriting?
Well, you can't afford to play with any ambiguities the way you can. I like the little nuances of meaning. I often bury in songs things which may be obscure to other listeners, but their particular personal references. When you hand a song over to somebody else, I think it's essential that it's in clearer language. I like to play with the meanings and sometimes twist the meanings of songs so that I start out with it meaning one thing and then it changes, I go from one position to the next. But when I write for other people, I tend to make myself much clearer.
You were saying that in a lot of the songs you've written for yourself, the meaning of the song changes as the song goes on, and that the song is most meaningful to you because you know all the subtleties of meaning in those lyrics. Can you think of a song that really illustrates that example?
Well, sometimes it's something comical, you know, like how a song may change over time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I started out with my first album, had a song on it called The Angels Want to Wear My Red Shoes, mm-hmm. which was about getting older and about slipping into the things that you always told yourself you wouldn't do as you got older. Well, the opening line is, I used to be disgusted, now I try to be amused. Well, when I sang it when I was 22 and I wrote it, 23 when it came out, I sang it with the anger of that youth, you know? Now, inevitably, there's a degree more acknowledgement that I've been both right and wrong in the time in between. And a more, perhaps, personal example is a song I've only just started doing recently on this last tour I've been doing with Steve Nye around the country, where we've been playing some of these songs. The second verse of the song is called, a song called Men Called Uncle. And it's about a man saying to his girlfriend, you know, well, you're going to go off with these older guys, there's no doubt. Well, of course, I was a young guy when I wrote it, you know. And the second verse goes, if I say you're the one, do you think that I'm serious? You get that kind of talk from older men. If I say I love you, then I must be delirious. So why are you trying to put my temperature up again? You see, I mean, obviously when I wrote that, you get that kind of talk from older men, it was me looking forward. Whether I like it or not now, that sounds funny because I am an older man now.
Right.
So at least to some of the audience, thankfully. You know?
As our listeners have heard, you've brought your guitar, and I'm delighted that you did. I'd like you to play something, if you could, from the new album, maybe the title track, All
yeah,
This
okay.
Useless Beauty.
I wrote this song I started it, at least, in Florence, in Italy. I was spending a month there, and I was very lucky because I spent a lot of time in galleries and churches and all these places with beautiful paintings, and spent the kind of time that modern people usually are not allowed with works that were obviously painted or sculpted for contemplation. And I also spent a lot of time watching people looking at them, whether or not they glanced at them and ticked them off on a list and moved on to the next thing, or whether or not they came in and had their own thought with them. And on one occasion, there was a woman who was looking at these beautiful, idealized statues and paintings, and then looked down at her husband, who was a less than perfect late 20th century model human, and started this song. It's a time such as this, she would be tempted to spit if she wasn't so ladylike. She imagines how she might have lived back when legends and history collide. So she looks to her prince, finding senses so charmingly slumped at her side. Those days are recalled on the gallery wall, and she's waiting for passion or humor to strike. What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty? All this useless beauty. Good Friday arrived, the sky darkened on time, till he almost began to negotiate. She held his head like a baby and said, it's okay if you cry. Now he wants her to dress as if you couldn't guess. He desires to impress his associates, but it's part ugly beast and Italian deceased. So she finds that the mixture is
heart, didn't I? 'Cosa potremmo fare con tutta questa bellezza, con tutta questa bellezza inutile? All this useless beauty. She won't practice the looks from the great tragic books that will lay to disgrace to face celluloid. You won't even make sense, but you can't bet if she isn't a sweetheart, a plaything or pen. The film turns her into an unveiled threat. Nonsense prevails, modesty fails, grace and virtue turn into stupidity. While a calendar fades, almost all barricades to a pale compromise. And our leaders have feasts on the backsides of beasts. They think they still think they're the gods of antiquity. If something you missed didn't even exist, it was just an ideal, is it such a surprise? What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty? All this useless beauty. What shall we do? What shall we do with all this useless beauty? All this useless beauty.
Elvis Costello, thanks so much for performing that. And that's the title track from Elvis Costello's new record, All This Useless Beauty. Elvis Costello recorded in 1996 after the release of his CD, All This Useless Beauty. His recordings are being gradually reissued by Rhino Records. We'll hear more of his interviews in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more interviews with Elvis Costello, including his appearance with Burt Bacharach, and John Powers reviews the new film, The Mothman Prophecies.
Why, I used to be disgusted, and now I try to be amused. But since the wings have got rusted, you know the angels want to wear my red shoes. But when they told me about the side of the bargain, that's when I won't get any older. Now the angels wanna wear my red shoes.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. All of Elvis Costello's recordings are gradually being reissued, along with material from the vaults, by Rhino Records. We're listening back to highlights of Costello's Fresh Air interviews. Let's get back to our 1996 interview, recorded after the release of his CD, All This Useless Beauty. Now, I understand you co-wrote a song with Burt Bacharach recently.
I did, yeah.
that you haven't recorded. How did you get together with him? And let me preface this by saying that his approach to songwriting is so different than yours, because he's an almost like post-Tin Pan Alley type of songwriter who's always written for other people.
Mm. Well, I think that he's not as dissimilar as it might appear, except in one obvious respect, that he is, he is classically trained to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and has a very broad experience, as you say. Wrote in the Brill Building, you know, and was simultaneously working with the Shirelles and Marlene Dietrich in the early 60s. So his experience of music is considerably broader and more varied than my own, where I started, you know, I really started out as a guitar-playing songwriter, whatever that's called, singer-songwriter it was called when I started out in the early, late 60s, in fact. It was the first time I ever performed in public. It was in 1969, although I was very young. And so, you know, there's no point of comparison in that, but over the years I have made reference to his style on a few occasions, a number of songs, quite a well-known song of mine that I did on my third album, Armed Forces, Accidents Will Happen. Doesn't sound anything like him, but in fact I distinctly remember sitting down at the piano and trying to work out Anyone Who Had a Heart as a kind of model, as something that I wanted to approach.
Really?
And I had several songs in mind of the kind of complexity that he could achieve when I wrote that song, but obviously the way in which it was played by a rock and roll band like The Attractions, albeit a very, very, very capable band, wouldn't sound like the kind of orchestral pop that he produced, say, with Dionne Warwick. So later on, I tried on a number of occasions to write in his style. I even covered a couple of his songs. I covered Just Don't Know What to Do with Myself, and later on I covered Baby, It's You. But I wrote a song in 1978 called Just a Memory, which again is a fairly obscure one in my repertoire. There is a version of it on a record called Taking Liberties, and it's available now on a on a reissue of one of my albums. I don't even know which one.
And any chance that you could play a bit of the song that you co-wrote with Burt Bacharach?
I'd love to, but unfortunately it's a piano song and there's no piano
in
the room.
Oh.
And also, truthfully, we are in a talk studio here, and although sort of, you know, quiet ballads which are more conversational are possible, this is a song that really requires to be sung in a singing space. It's very rangy.
Could you do just a few lines of it a cappella, just to give us a sense of the melody?
I'll just play a little bit of it.
Great.
Now I have nothing, so God give me strength, 'cause I'm weak in a way. And if I'm strong, I might still break. And I don't have anything to share that I won't throw away into the air. That song is sung out. This bell is rung out. She was the light that I'd bless. She took my last chance of happiness. So God, give me strength. God, give me strength. Hey, there was a little preview there.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, it's a pretty tune. I mean,
let me ask you. Yeah, I'm sorry. Was it interesting for you to hear Burt Bacharach's suggestions and additions, you know, additions and changes to your melody? I mean, what did you learn from hearing how he changed it?
They weren't the changes in the melody so much as the changes in the harmony, which are hard. That's why I say it's harder for me to express accurately what,
like the
contribution of, yeah, just the voicings of the chords and the, you know, I mean, I tend to use simple I'm a fairly rudimentary guitar player, and even more so on the piano. I can play my own sort of accompaniments, whereas he is a school musician who thinks both vertically and horizontally. I tend to think only horizontally.
You know what I really love? Is there any chance that you could play a couple of the lines the way you wrote it and then show us the harmonic changes that Burt Bacharach made?
There isn't really, no, because I would have to... For one thing, I can't remember what they were originally, because this has become fixedly the version of the song. And secondly, you would need a piano to really illustrate that. You wouldn't hear it on the guitar.
Right.
It's very hard. I mean, what's interesting is I can play you a few bars of the bridge to show you the contrast, because that opening statement, with minus the amendments, is largely my invention, because somebody has to start things rolling. So the second time round it gets to the bridge, it goes, God give me strength. God, if she'd grant me her indulgence and decline, I might as well wipe her from her memory. See what I mean? That's where the problem is. It starts getting very high. And it's not really designed to be done in here, I don't think.
Right.
But, I mean, that's where the language of the harmony completely changes there, you know, And it goes into a whole other world, which I won't pursue now, because it really doesn't sound like very much without the full accompaniment. You know, you need 20 strings and a couple of flugelhorns to go up there, you know?
You know how you were saying that Burt Bacharach modified some of the harmonies on the song as you were writing it? I'm wondering, when Chet Baker recorded your song Almost Blue, did he and the musicians who he played with change any of the harmonies on the song?
Well, the accompaniment is so sparse, it's very hard to hear any of the harmony. I mean, it's a pretty much a found melody, you know. I mean Chet Baker sang "The Thrill Is Gone" like this: "The thrill is gone, the thrill is gone." You know, it's just like that. It's like a plain vibratoless, like just plaintive tune.
And "The Thrill Is Gone" is the song that inspired in part, Baker's version of "The Thrill Is Gone" inspired in part your song Almost Blue.
Yeah, Almost Blue. And I mean, you can hear the similarities in
Almost Blue, almost doing things we used to do. There's a girl here and she's almost you, almost all the things that your eyes once promised, I see in hers too. Now your eyes are from crying almost blue. Flirting with this disaster became me. It named me as the fool who only aimed to be almost blue. It's almost touching, it will almost do. There is part of me that's always true, always. Not all good things come to an end now, it is only a chosen few. I have seen such an unhappy couple almost be almost you, almost blue.
God, Gosh, I love that song. I really like the way you did it, too. That was just wonderful. You wrote Almost Blue with Chet Baker in mind because his recording of The Thrill Is Gone kind of inspired your song. How did Chet Baker get his hands on your song and record
it
himself?
Well, I gave it to him. I gave him a copy of it. He came in to play on a record of ours called Shipbuilding, which was a very unlikely song. It was music by a friend of mine, Clive Langer, and words by myself. And it was written during the Falklands War. And I heard a plaintive voice, and I didn't really know who I wanted. You know, I mean, my absolute ideal of the record was Miles. And I didn't think in a million years I would be able to get Miles. And by sheer chance, like, we no sooner started recording, but I opened the paper one day, and Chet Baker, who was a very elusive character and very rarely kept to any kind of predictable schedule, usually scheduled dates at very short notice, suddenly appeared in London. He hadn't played in London in about 15 years. And the very week we were recording, he turned up in London playing a little club date. And I went along and introduced myself, and he had absolutely no idea who I was, except I was one of the more polite people in the club, you know, that was a very, very noisy club full of jazz critics talking, ordering drinks at the tops of their voices, you know, and giving him absolutely no respect. And I said, would he come down and play a session? And he turned up the next day with his trumpet and played this trumpet solo. And at the end of it, I gave him a copy of the record, Imperial Bedroom, which contained Almost Blue, which was the previous record we'd made, mm-hmm. and said that I'd written it with him in mind and perhaps he'd like to listen to it. And a few years later, I heard a rumour that he was doing my song. But although I had seen him several times in the meanwhile, he had never mentioned any interest in the song. And although I had given him a copy of the record, he never mentioned it, and I never pressed him on it. And shortly after his death, somebody told me that he had recorded it, so I didn't hear his version until after he died.
Elvis Costello recorded in 1996. He later collaborated on an entire CD with Burt Bacharach. We'll hear Costello and Bacharach talk about it after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to highlights of Elvis Costello's Fresh Air interviews 2 years after collaborating with Burt Bacharach on the song God Give Me Strength for the film Grace of My Heart. Costello and Bacharach collaborated on a CD called Painted from Memory. After it was released in 1998, I spoke with Costello and Bacharach. Elvis Costello, what have you learned from working with Burt Bacharach about the construction of songs, about harmonics and meter and all of that?
Well, obviously you have different dispositions about harmony. And also, I mean, I've always been intrigued by Burt's use of uneven meter. And I can't say I've imitated it, but I found myself doing it. I think if you're not a particularly schooled musician, you might do it in a very natural way. And I think the reason that those odd bars now and again in Burt's compositions work so effectively is because they're never done with self-consciousness. They're done to enhance the naturalistic way in which people express themselves. I think it mirrors the way we speak or the way we think in uneven phrases. We don't think all exactly in 4/4. And therefore, you know, we confide and then we suddenly blurt something out. Well, I think that's where the passion lies in his compositions.
I've tried to never do it for effect or
never,
just to
never
be different.
Seems for effect, you know?
I mean, sometimes I got a little bit perplexed when I tried to write it down and suddenly realized, oh my God, it's a 7/8 bar, you know?
But it feels natural. When we perform Anyone Who Had a Heart, I never think twice about what it is. I mean, we've been performing some of Burt's songs that contain, and there are some aspects of them. I mean, My Thief has a bar of 5/4 in the first verse, in each of the opening verse. And it doesn't seem unnatural. You know?
Well, we want to not only make it feel natural for you, the comfort level as songwriters, but also that listening audience out there that's not going to see that as a pimple going by, that 5/4 bar.
Throw them on another foot, and that, you know, it's not as if we're making dance records, but there
we're
should
not.
Be.
We're not. Now you tell me, Elvis.
Oh, no.
You said, come on, we're going to, after God give us strength, it'll all be like dancing.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when I, like, for instance, listened to Promises, Promises, I never thought to myself, gee, what a tricky set of signature, time signature changes. But, and the sheet music, if you look at the sheet music, the line promises, those kind of promises take all the joy from life. There's one bar of 3/4, followed by a bar of 4/4, followed by a bar of 6/4, then 3/4, 4/4, then 6/4. And then promises, promises, my kind of promises, that's 3/4, 3/8, and then 4/8. I mean, who even sees 3/8 in sheet music? So, Bert Bacharach, these kind of shifts just come into your mind, and then you write them down, and that's when you realize how tricky they are?
Well, I think that was driven, yeah, that certainly was driven by the intensity of what that had to say theatrically on stage. And
right, because that was written for the show Promises, Promises.
Right. So it had to have a drive of its own.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I heard it, played it, then started to notate it, write it down. Oh, my goodness, we got a 3/8 bar. And here comes another 3/8 bar, because it can't be a 6/8 bar, putting the two 3/8s together. It's a 3/8, it's a 3/8, it's a 4/8. And even when I'm doing it, like, with a symphony orchestra now, try to get them to think, to add one thing. Instead of just counting the 3/8, 3/8, 4/8, to hear what the girls are singing or hear the musical content rather than reading those eighth notes and go, promises, promises, and one. So right there, that takes care of your 7/8 bar, you see? Promises, promises, and one. Bum, da, 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 da. But if they don't sing in their head, I mean, the background voices and the strings are playing da ba da ba da da. See? The girls are going promises, promises. And the trumpet players have to come in one beat later. So it'd be promises, promises, bum, bum. But if they can hear in their head promises, promises, and one, if they count that way, it's a breeze. It's simple.
So, and, a music lesson for you.
Of course, the symphony orchestra sometimes would look at me with great dismay and say, what is this man saying?
I mean, this is the kind of stuff that you can everyday work together throws up, you know. Obviously, to go back to your question about harmonics, or harmony, I should say, I mean, I've written a good degree of music down, particularly when I've worked with musicians from the classical and jazz field who are more used to the written page. But when it comes to popular song, of course, working in a rock band, you hardly ever write anything down. Sometimes a string overlay of a rhythm section, but the rhythm section parts, the chord progressions are very simple, and it would be stupid to write them down. They're too easy to remember. You would inhibit yourself in the communication.
But don't you think that orchestration aside, that a lot of rock musicians don't even know most of the chords or many of the chords that Bacharach would use in his compositions? You know, that the more complicated jazz chords, for instance.
Very possible.
Or they stumble on them and they don't know them by name, or they don't know them instantly. But you do hear some very complex things happen in records that they're just not necessarily schooled in.
Because
Right.
But, the interesting thing for me is the rock musicians, and this is generalization, that have trouble there and don't necessarily play that minor second and that chord. And R&B players, it's a different thing.
Yeah.
They go to the minor second like it's in their system, in their blood. It's a natural thing. They go into different kind of loops, both rhythmically and harmonically, because it's a... And they may not be able to write it down.
Yeah, there's also the other side of it, isn't there? That it can be a loop, and you get jazz players who defer to particular intervals that allow them to speak in a language that's understood by other jazz musicians, but that, you know, you're starting to hear... these voicings all the time, and they can't play a playing chord. You know,
yeah,
they couldn't play a playing chord.
Well.
You know, it's almost like a heresy to them. And I think there's a little bit of a trap in that only
Absolutely.
Being able to voice in complex harmony and to not see that there is a beautiful thing in Hank Williams' song with just playing harmony. You know,
Elvis Costello and Bert Bacharach recorded in 1998 after the release of their CD Painted for Memory. Olaf Costello's recordings are gradually being re-released by Rhino Records along with material from the vaults. Three more releases are scheduled for mid-February.
Romeo was restless, he was ready to kill. He jumped out the window cause he couldn't sit still. Juliet was waiting with the safety net. Said, don't bury me cause I'm not dead yet. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied. Well, I remember when the lights went out and I was trying to make it look like it was never in doubt. She thought that I knew and I thought that she knew. So both of us were willing, but we didn't know how to do it. Why don't you tell me about the mystery dance? I wanna know about the mystery dance. Why don't you show me? Cause I tried and I'm still mystified. I can't do it anymore and I'm not satisfied.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new film, The Mothman Prophecies. This is Fresh Air. The Mothman Prophecies is a new eerie thriller based on a true-life outbreak of weirdness in Point Pleasant, West Virginia. The events took place over a 13-month period, beginning in November 1966. The movie stars Richard Gere and Laura Linney. Film critic John Powers has a review.
Normally, when a movie starts, we pretty much know already what's going to happen all the way through. The lovers will face obstacles but then get together, or the murderer will taunt the cops but eventually get caught. But over the last few months, we've been offered a group of new films that my wife calls What the Heck is Going On movies. Memento, Mulholland Drive, Vanilla Sky, even A Beautiful Mind. Far from telling familiar, straightforward stories, they're deliberately designed to disorient us, to knock us off our bearings. They make us wonder what's real here and what's fantasy. You'll find yourself asking just that during The Mothman Prophecies, an enjoyable new thriller that has a clumsy opening half hour, but soon becomes thoroughly engrossing. Richard Gere stars as John Klein, a star reporter for The Washington Post who seems to have it made. Then his beloved wife Mary, played by Deborah Messing of Will and Grace fame, dies when she crashes her car after seeing a strange moth-like figure as she speeds along the road. 2 years later, the bereaved John is still haunted by her memory. Driving down to Richmond to interview the governor of Virginia, John suddenly finds himself in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, 500 miles in the wrong direction. And he's only been on the road for 90 minutes. The ironically named Point Pleasant is a town whose locals have been dealing with baffling things. Sightings of a spooky red-eyed creature some call the Mothman. Telephone calls from inhuman voices that utter deadly prophecies that have a way of coming true. Along with a good-looking local cop, that's Laura Linney in a thankless role, Klein tries to figure out what's going on. Could these really be spiritual or extraterrestrial visitations? And if so, what do you do with them? Here, he gets advice from an expert in unearthly visitations and prophecies, played with fierce intensity by the superb English actor Alan Bates.
Last week, my friend got a strange phone call from an entity, spirit, whatever. Seemed to know everything.
My God. And he made predictions.
Yeah.
And they came true.
Yes. His name was Indrid Cold.
It's perception, John. They appear differently to everyone. A voice, a light, a man, a monster. If your friend thinks he's talking to God, he's off by more than a few degrees.
But how do you explain it? Knows everything.
Hey, look at that. If there was a car crash 10 blocks away, that window washer up there could probably see it. Now, that doesn't mean he's God. Or even smarter than we are.
But from where he's sitting, he can see a little further down the road.
The Mothman Prophecies was directed by Mark Pellington, whose last film, Arlington Road, worked a similar emotional terrain. That picture was about a terrorism expert, also with a dead wife, who becomes fixated on the notion that the people next door are terrorists. But as we watch, we keep wondering if he could be going crazy. The same dynamic is at work here. We're never quite sure whether Klein is unraveling cosmically significant events or simply sliding into obsession. Richard Gere is not always the world's most expressive actor, but here his limitations serve him well. Rather than thrusting the movie into hysteria each time something weird happens, seeing his dead wife, for instance, his low-key grimaces help keep the movie from rocketing into melodrama. And Pellington does a spectacular job of making us feel Klein's feverish hunt for the truth, conjuring up a mysterious world through his riveting use of sound and striking production design. In Point Pleasant, Klein stays in a motel with burgundy walls and oddball lamps. It seems to be owned by David Lynch. Far more skillfully than A Beautiful Mind, The Mothman Prophecy lets us know how it feels to find coded messages everywhere. Almost every shot seems to contain something that resembles a moth, or takes on a recurrent Y shape, whose meaning I won't give away here. Of course, finding patterns everywhere is the very essence of paranoia, and The Mothman Prophecies is probably best described as a paranoid thriller. Not the political kind that Hollywood turned out 20 years ago, in pictures like 3 Days of the Condor, The Parallax View, or Cutter's Way, but the pulpy extraterrestrial kind you had in the 1950s. It harks back to pictures like Invasion of the Body Snatchers or Village of the Damned. And like classic pulp, Klein's visit to Point Pleasant builds to an exciting climax fraught with uncertainties. We can't guess whether Klein will save the town from prophesied disasters, somehow reunite with his dead wife through the intervention of the Mothman, or himself be destroyed by his own desperate search for the truth. Although Klein's quest is the hyperbolic stuff of thrillers, he's merely confronting a heightened version of the existential issues that we all deal with every day. How do we find some sense in life, with all its seeming portents and inescapable tragedies? How do we handle losses that linger in our minds, often more powerfully than what stands alive before us? In the end, The Mothman Prophecies is about that most human of problems. How to go on living when we often don't know what the heck is going on.
John Powers is media columnist and executive editor of the LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Cherry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Dialogues of the Dead by Reginald Hill, a novel of British psychological suspense. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Trembling Before God is the new documentary about gays and lesbians who are Orthodox or Hasidic Jews. On the next Fresh Air, we meet Sandy Dubowski, the filmmaker, Steven Greenberg, the first openly gay Orthodox rabbi, and Michelle, a lesbian who was raised in a Hasidic family. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.